Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayamadirayet. Before reciting this Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Narayan, and unto Narayan Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author and compiler of Srimad Bhagavatam. Nasta Preshwabadeshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagatutim Shloke Bhaktir Bhavatina Ishtiki. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam and by rendering of service to the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service unto the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. Om Agnati Mirandasya Kenanjana Shalakaya Chaksurun Militam Yena Tashmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 18th chapter, verse 32. Jarayujam. Is that the one there? Yes. Svedajam Andajodbinam. Jarayujam Svedajam Andajodbinam. Karacharam Devarsi Pritri Pritributam Aindriyam Karacharam Devarsi Pritributam Aindriyam Dua Tam Shita Kashiti Salya Sakrit Samudra Dayo Kam Shkiti Salya Sakrit Samudra. Dvipa Grahar Kshiti Avideya Eka Dvipa Grihar Kshethi Abhideya Eka Jarayujam Svedajam Andajodbinam Karacharam Devarsi Piti Bhutama Indrayam Jyaukam Stitya Stiti Salya Sakrit Samudra Dvipa Grihar Seti Abideya Eka Jarayujam Svedajam Andajodbidam Karacharam Devarsi Pitributam Aindriyam Dhyakam Stiti Salya Sakrit Samudra Dvipa Grakarkseti Avideya Eka Jarayujam Svedajam Adhoksibinam Jaracharam Devarsi Piti Bhutamandram Jaravam Stiti Sanyasi Pitsumadram Yuvagi Harkseti Avideya Eka Jaracharam Ladies, Charajitam Sivatam Maruksijitam Atam Devarsipichi Bhutam Anjiyam. Jarayujam, one born from a womb. Svedajam, one born from perspiration. Andaja, one born from an egg. Ubidam, one born of the earth. Kara Acharam, the moving and the stationary. Deva, the demigods. Rishi, the great sages. Pitri, the inhabitants of Pitri Loka. Bhutam, the material elements. Air, fire, water, and earth. Andriyam, all the senses. Dhyā, the higher planetary systems. Kam, the sky. Siti, the earthly planets. Saila, the hills and mountains. Sarit, the rivers. Samudra, the oceans. Dvipa, the islands. Grahakshe, the stars and planets. Iti, thus. Abhideya, to be variously named. Eka, one. Translation: my dear Lord, you manifest your different energies in countless forms as living entities born from wombs, from eggs, and from perspiration, as plants and trees that grow out of the earth, as all living entities, both moving and standing, including the demigods, the learned sages, and the pitas, as outer space, as the higher planetary system containing the heavenly planets, and as the planet Earth with its hills, rivers, seas, oceans, and islands. Indeed, all the stars and planets are simply manifestations of your different energies. But originally, you are one without a second. Therefore, there is nothing beyond you. This entire cosmic manifestation is therefore not false, but is simply a temporary manifestation of your inconceivable energy. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This verse completely rejects the theory of Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya, which states that spirit or Brahman is real, whereas the manifested material world with its great variety of things is false. nothing is false. One may be permanent and another temporary, but both the permanent and the temporary are facts. For example, if someone becomes angry for a certain period, no one can say that his anger is false. It is simply temporary. Everything we experience in our daily lives is of this same character. It is temporary, but real. The different kinds of living entities coming from various sources are very clearly described in this verse. Some are born from a womb, and some, like certain insects, from human perspiration. Others hatch from eggs, and still others sprout from the earth. A living entity takes birth under different circumstances according to his past activities, karma. Although the body of a living entity is material, it is never false. No one will accept the argument that since a person's material body is false, murder has no repercussions. Our temporary bodies are given to us according to our karma, and we must remain in our given bodies to enjoy the pains and pleasures of life. Our bodies cannot be called false. They are only temporary. In other words, the energy of the Supreme Lord is as permanent as the Lord himself, although his energy is sometimes manifested and sometimes not. As summarized in the Vedas, Sarvam Kaya Idam Brahma, everything is Brahman. So we can ascertain from this verse that six different points. Brahman is truth, and everything is Brahman, and therefore we are Brahman. But we have forgotten this reality and replaced it with the false idea that we are of the material nature and are only temporary beings dependent on matter. So this is the crux of material attitude, that we are temporary beings and that we are dependent on these material bodies for our existence. This permeates Christian philosophy, this idea that God manifested as Jesus Christ so that he could experience humanity, so he could experience what it is to be human, so he could experience what it is to be confused. Because many scholars look at Jesus and they try to see the evolution of his consciousness to the point where he actually realized that he was of a divine nature. And we are all of a divine nature. We are all sons of God, just as Jesus was a son of God. But the difference between Jesus and us at this particular stage of our development is that Jesus had realized that he was part and parcel of the Supreme Person. Jesus never said he was God. Many different times he said, I am completely dependent on the Father. Without the Father, I'm nothing. So he had no existence. He felt he had no existence apart from the Father. Never that he was equal to the Father. That is a discrepancy brought about in later Christian philosophy, later Christian dogma. So Brahman's spirit is eternal. Material nature is finite. It's not infinite, and it rises and subsides. So the Christians and different religious groups, they look forward to the end of the world, end of times, and they think that material nature will be finished completely. They don't really understand that the material world, it rises and it falls. It's a cyclical event. Einstein, he dealt with the question of the eternal nature of the universe. Thus, people were thinking, the universe, it must be eternal. Or is it finite? Is it material? So he asked this question. He said, we see everything in the universe has a beginning and an end. And therefore, the universe itself must also be temporary and come to an end. This is very brilliant philosophy. Answered by any child who has read a few pages of the Bhagavad Gita or the Bhagavatam. But anyway, this answer serves well enough on the material plane. If you're a materialist, yes, you can agree everything will come to an end. But the material is not all there is. This is the mistake of the scientists. This is the mistake of these brilliant men like Einstein and Hawking, these different people. They have no idea of what is behind matter. What is the motivation? What is the? They think it's simply electrical chemicals, charged, who have developed the ability to think, and somehow the ability to realize that they exist. But they think the whole show is temporary. They think it's all essentially like the Mayavadis. They think it's all illusion. It's all a temporary show. They don't see the reality of it. So while Einstein was right, there is a destruction of the universe. He was not aware that such destruction would not be the end of all existence. So the end of the universe, the dissolution of the universe, is not the end of existence, because existence, spirit, is not dependent on matter. Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor will you ever cease to be. So this eternal nature is there whether or not you're embodied or not embodied. But this is the crux of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada emphasized this so many times. You are not this body. We are not these bodies. These bodies are a temporary shell, and the eternal soul goes on. So when the body is finished, which is the end of the world for us in a sense, each individual has his own end of the world. I remember Christians used to ask, when we were at Sangha, what do you think about the end of the world? This is back in the 70s, concerned. And so many prophecies are there that the world will end at this time and at that time and so forth. But we haven't seen it quite yet. It's not really due for some time. At any rate, they're very concerned. But I used to answer, is that, well, actually, the end of the world comes at our time of our death. So the world as we know it, the world that has been given to this particular karmic representation, this representation of karma, when this ends, that's the end of my world. But we're not the body. We're not this karmic representation. We are spirit souls, and we go on forever. So not to be concerned about the end of the world and considering that, oh, this will also be the end of me. If everything is destroyed by fire, by atomic bombs or whatever, then this will be the end of me. No, it's just another change, just another change. So Einstein, he was very much favored as a scientist, because he delved only into the physical nature of the universe. He only dealt with matter. He never took his consciousness into spirit. He actually considered God, and then he rejected him. I was under the illusion at one point that he had actually begun to think of a personal God. He imagined there must be a personal God behind the manifestation of the universe. But I saw one letter recently. It sold for several hundred thousand dollars from Einstein, negating that he had any inclination towards spiritual life. And he had any inclination. He felt if there was a God, if you want to call the force that started the universe God, that he went, set things in motion, and then left. It's basically his idea. So we're not taking this very limited knowledge of the PhDs, of the scientists, we're not taking it very seriously. Prabhupada said, you kick on their face with a boot. Because they're so misdirected and so limited in their vision. If you want to learn something, you go to someone who has a great vision, an overall scope, an overall picture of what is reality. His scope, Einstein's scope of conception, was very limited by his commitment to matter. He had a commitment to matter, to physics. He could not see beyond this. And so spirit or energy, this is only, he considered spirit or energy to be only a subtle form of matter. His relativity theory, E equals mc squared, matter, or energy equals matter squared. Who knows what that means? I was told only 5 or 6 people in the world understood what that meant. But the idea is that energy is constant. Energy never, it changes form, but it is constant. So he had at least that much understanding, but still he could not define what that energy was. He could not understand that it was a mystical potency coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And as a result, we can understand that everyone here, seriously watching this program, the viewers out there like this, anyone who has made a commitment to pursue the study of Krishna, you're potentially more intelligent than Einstein. Yes, this is true. You actually have a vision of what is spiritual. You have a vision of yourself as spirit soul. There's 3 different types of Atma, the body, the mind, and the spirit. So you know you're not your body, and you know your mind is easily deceived and has misconceptions and so forth. But the spirit that we don't quite touch, we're not quite in contact with the spirit, we're not realizing that we are pure spiritual beings. The spirit, in its pure state, is more than just energy. It's more than just some active force or some drive like that. The spirit actually has a loving relationship. The soul has a loving relationship with the Supreme Lord. And this is so far, this understanding is so far beyond what the scientists can imagine, their very limited knowledge. It is so far beyond it. So as devotees of Krishna, we're training ourselves to see beyond matter and into the spiritual realms. You're not this body. That's immediately an indication that you're something else. And the question arises, what am I? What am I? So to just say, well, you're energy, that's not very much information. Not very much information. The real information is that you're a spirit soul and you have a loving relationship with Krishna. And this is Krishna. He looks like this. He acts like this. He has so many different loving pastimes and exchanges with his devotees called rasa. So this is who we really are. Entities seeking to regain that footing, that position in the spiritual world with the Supreme Personality of God, with the Supreme Spirit. We're trying to get to that stage again. But we start with these basic deduction that we're souls and not merely bodies, and then we progress to the understanding that we're part and parcel of the Supreme Spiritual Progenitor, Sri Krishna. We acknowledge God as our Father, and we worship Him. If we're fortunate, we come in contact with pure devotees who teach us bhakti, and by the devotional route, we come to enjoy drawing closer to God. So this bhakti process that we practice, it draws us closer and closer and closer to Krishna. It is simply a very eloquent, very blissful, very organized process of developing full love of God. That is what our program is. That's all our program is. It's not to create a better world here in the material world, not to facilitate a world government, not to develop a paramilitary or an army, something like that, to enforce Krishna consciousness. Our business is to practice bhakti yoga just as it's presented in the Nectar of Devotion with the idea of self-containment, self-discipline. And this discipline takes the form of the practices of the yoga system. Chanting, hearing, the different aspects of these different processes draw us closer and closer to Krishna. So these sentiments are spiritual, emotional triumphs. As we enjoy drawing closer to Krishna, we feel closer, we feel a sense of achievement. These create a desire in us to know more and more about Krishna. So we feed our addiction with more and more information about the Supreme Lord. And this information increases our ecstasy. We discover His desires for us and easily put aside our mundane desires. How does one become renounced? Simply by discovering what Krishna wants for us, by relishing what He wants for us, just by knowing that Krishna wants us to go back to Him, wants us to be with Him, is very anxious for us to do this. By knowing this, this is an incredible encouragement that God actually wants you. So many people, they lose their faith in God when they feel abandoned by God because they have been very sinful. But here the Shastra is telling us that God wants you to come back to Him. He wants you very much. And He's anxious for that special rasa, that unique individual rasa that He's created in you, each of you different spirit souls. He's anxious to explore that again. But we've deprived Krishna from this. So our business is to stop this depriving the Supreme Lord and to placate Him, to make Him happy again, to satisfy Him. And we understand that by feeding the stomach, the whole body is nourished. Simply by satisfying the Supreme Lord, our bliss, our happiness, our security is secured. We get all this wonderful advantage. We get all the advantages. So, if we're tired of material life, and we see it as more or less pointless, especially if you understand reincarnation and the constant ups and downs of the living entity, one time a king, one time a beggar in the street, sometimes an animal, sometimes a beast of burden, sometimes a poisonous snake like this. So many different alternatives are there for us. Once we see the pointlessness of this, that we'll never become the Supreme Person, that we'll never become satisfied here. Is Lord Brahma satisfied even though he has so many heavenly enjoyments? No, he's not. He's not really. It's just a proclivity. He has a great proclivity to control, and therefore Krishna gives him an opportunity. The demigods all have this great proclivity to control, and they're very pious, so Krishna puts them in charge of some aspect of universal affairs. But is that the goal of life, to become a big controller, big Ishwara? No. The goal of life is to develop love for Krishna. So any person can do that. You don't have to be in the status of a demigod. You simply have to be a sincere soul wanting to return to Krishna. So when we're tired of this material life and we see it as pointless, these such desires are easy to renounce. What is the point of taking on something that you don't really need, that you don't really want to use? Like, for instance, the idea of a sweater. Now the weather is very warm, so there's no need for sweaters, there's no need for heavy chadar, etc. When the weather changes, yes, there's some need, so we take these things on. But if it's not, if the weather is like this, we don't need these things. So similarly, we don't need so many things that we present to ourselves as important in material life. Some of those things are like control. One of those things is like control. Once we realize we have no control, we're actually very much freed. So by chanting and hearing, and the other devotional process recommended, we quickly advance past Shraddha to the platform of having a taste, ruchi, for spiritual life. Subsequent levels of elevation unfold as the soul re-evolves back to full knowledge of his original constitutional position in the spiritual world. So this is our gain, this is our goal. Who am I in relationship to Krishna? Sometimes when children are abandoned by their parents and they grow up in either foster home or they're adopted by someone else, they come to want to know, who is my biological father or mother? Become absorbed in this. They become very absurd, it's almost absurd. They have a loving parent in the form of their caretaker, the personality who has given them essentially parental guidance throughout their life. They have this person, but they're absorbed in who is my real biological father, who is my real biological mother. So these things are, this is actually inconsequential. What is actually important is, who is our father, who is God, who are we in relationship to God? This is important. So this is the identity that we're trying to establish, not that I'm the son of so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. And material lineage is not very important. So, actually what happens as we arrive on these higher levels, there's no need to argue about what platform one is on. And such concerns are actually a manifestation of false ego. When you arrive on each higher platform, each higher level, one naturally feels more humble. The closer one reaches or moves towards the Supreme Lord, who is humility personified, the more humble he becomes. So mundane pride of achievement, people achieve something, they feel very proud, it dissolves as we progress. The false ego is dissolved by the process of devotional service. So as we see Krishna as the doer, he is the allower of our progress towards him. Not that we are making progress ourselves by our own strength or by our own mystic potency, but we know we have placed ourselves in Krishna's hands and we are patiently waiting for his mercy. This is the way that we progress in Krishna consciousness, not by demanding or putting on a show of devotion. We approach Krishna, we make advancement by waiting for his mercy and praying sincerely to rejoin him, to be accepted. So pure humility becomes the life and joy of the living entity. In this mood he becomes fit to appear before the Lord. The pastimes in the spiritual world are performed on a platform of pure humility. It's absolutely pure humility. All of the residents there are in this humble state. They're all anxious to see others move forward to Krishna. There's never any enmity that I want Krishna for myself. But they're happy to see others advance towards Krishna. So if one is not humble, his feet will burn on such a platform of pure humility. He will not be able to tolerate it. You'll have to run away from it. So, being smarter than Einstein, which perhaps not all devotees are, but this is not an ego trip. This is not an identity trip that I'm greater than the greatest scientist. It's not an identity merit badge or a PhD hung neatly on the wall. It's the natural consequence of having a fully open mind to the power and greatness of God. Humility comes when we understand how great God is. Without such a fully open mind towards God, how can one fully understand God? Without being really open to whatever God wants, how can you understand? It's not possible. So many people, they develop an attitude against God because he didn't give this. And Prabhupada used the example in the Second World War. People were in Germany, they became very atheistic because they were praying to win the war and they were praying to have their children, their sons and husbands returned to them unhurt, and so many died, and so they became atheistic. Couldn't understand how this horrible thing. In England also, people became atheistic after the war. Churches have fallen into disrepair and disuse. Because people are no longer satisfied, because they're looking to God for some material solution, not to rejoin God. They're looking for some material compensation, and it's never there in material life. Even you become a Lord Brahma, ultimately there's a dissolution. Ultimately everything is finished. So people have the wrong attitude. A devotee once asked Prabhupada, What was real humility? What is real humility? Prabhupada's answer was very simple. Humility means you only depend on Krishna, not on your intelligence, or your family, your bank balance, your health, not on your gun, only on Krishna for everything. He said that, not on your gun. He's talking to Americans. So like this, when we are... Wants us to assert our false ego. I'm the controller, the enjoyer, I'm the primeval cause of all causes. Even for a moment, if Maya can get us to fall into such thinking, we are for that time lost on the path to Krishna. According to our karma, we suffer and enjoy. Both are unavoidable. But devotional service gives us the option to offer either our pains or our pleasures to Krishna. For his pleasure. So we can offer our difficulties. My dear Lord, I'm offering you the difficulty of this old body. And the other day I had a very interesting realization. Usually when I pay my obeisances, I make a face, it's so difficult. But I thought, if I just smile while I'm offering obeisances, let me see how that works. And it worked very nicely. I didn't feel so much anxiety. I didn't feel, the face is the index of the mind. So if we just simply, Krishna is smiling sweetly as he listens to Arjuna's lament. If we imitate Krishna in this way, we just smile and accept situations as they are. Okay, the body's old, it's in anxiety, it's difficult to deal with. But this is Krishna's arrangement. I'm going to offer the pains and pleasures of the body to Krishna. I'm going to smile as I undergo something that seems a little painful. And the result is there's pleasure. There's actual pleasure. So I hope I can keep that realization. So keeping in mind that the goal of life is achieving Krishna consciousness, not dependent on pursuing pleasure or avoiding pain. If we move on in this way, we'll be satisfied. So I was asked to speak something a little bit about Lord Jagannath. I want to say that Lord Jagannath has the most wonderful smile. Lord Jagannath is a form of an incarnation of Krishna's ecstasy. This is what Krishna's ecstasy looks like. And it's very difficult to see Lord Jagannath without smiling and appreciating. So Lord Jagannath gives so much shelter to his devotee. There's a story floating around about Ram Das. He wrote a four-page story about his visit. He was a devotee in Alachua. And somehow he made it onto the cart of Lord Jagannath at Rath Yatra. He wanted to touch Lord Jagannath's feet. You know. And so somehow or another, this young boy, he was about 18 or 16, something like that. And he went to Puri. He was here in Mayapur at the school. He spent several years here. His brother is here now. Anyway, he went and he got onto the Rath Yatra cart. They asked, you know, they wanted money and so forth. He said, "I don't have any money." So they let him go anyway. He got up on the cart and he paid his obeisances in front of Lord Jagannath. And then he was ushered away. You know, the pandas took him away. But somehow he went around the back and he came back again. You know, the panda said, "Have you seen the Lord?" Said, "Well, not to my full satisfaction." So he went back again. And he paid his obeisances in front of Lord Jagannath. And all of a sudden a pile of people came and just mobbed, you know, fell on top of him. Everybody was paying obeisances. Everybody's on top of each other. So he said he spent about 10 minutes there at Lord Jagannath's feet. He was very, very pleased. So this was his desire. So when we have a desire to serve Krishna in a certain way, Krishna fulfills it. I wanted to tell a story about my wife, Mahamaya. My wife came to Krishna consciousness rather accidentally. Actually, some friends... Nothing is an accident, yes. But at any rate, some friends actually took her to the Boston Temple. She was, you might say, having a psychotic episode. And the only thing she could really do was chant. So basically, they left her there. They took her to the temple and they said, "Here, she belongs here with you." And so... she stayed, and some very kind devotees, very sincere kind devotees were there, and they were doing Sankirtan, and the next day she was doing Sankirtan on the Boston Commons. They took care of her, took her in, gave her a sari, and her life changed. So, at one point, Mahamaya, she was testing Lord Jagannath. And this is early in her devotional career. She took darshan of Lord Jagannath, and she, in her mind, in her innocent neophyte bewilderment, she asked the Lord to reveal to her that he was indeed God. "So are you really God?" She asked that question. And so Mahamaya claims that Lord Jagannath then winked at her. You know, he winked at her, you know, with his eye. He has a very nice big eye. So he winked this eye. So in my experience, Mahamaya is very truthful, and so we can accept that actually happened. At another later time, some years later, when Mahamaya was a Brahmin Pujari, on the occasion of New Vrindavan Temple being attacked by a motorcycle gang, she was on the altar dressing the deities when the dacoits entered in the temple and the curtain was closed. Before the demon came on the altar, Mahamaya and Kutila Devi Dasi took all three of the Jagannath deities and little Radha Krishna and hid them behind a curtain. So she was able to serve Lord Jagannath in that very special way. Can we turn off this whatever fan that is that's making the noise? Thank you. So offer all our pleasures and pains to Krishna. So those are two simple stories about Lord Jagannath that I had. And we're all enjoying his darshan every morning. It's very, very wonderful. We can appreciate that the Lord has come in this form of his ecstasy just to enliven us. I went to the Rath Yatra and I, in my decrepit condition, and I found myself walking very fast, walking faster than I usually ever walk, in order to get in front of the first chariot, Lord Balaram's chariot. And I just began to feel a great satisfaction, a very great pleasure. So Krishna is the giver of all pleasure. Lord Jagannath is an especially merciful form of the Lord. He gives pleasure to everyone. I remember many times in New York, Rath Yatra, seeing many people on the sides of the street. They're there watching the parade. Most of them kind of dumbfounded. You know, what is this? They had no idea what's going on. They've never seen anything like it. Their mouths are just open, you know. What is this? So many tourists in New York come out on a Saturday to walk down Fifth Avenue, and they see this incredible procession, and they're stunned. So this is the nature of Lord Jagannath, that he's stunning. This form he has is stunning. He himself is stunned in this form, hearing the devotees talk about their ecstasy. So this is our opportunity here this week to render some service directly to Lord Jagannath. Very, very auspicious time. So I'll stop here and ask if there are any questions or comments. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Thank you very much. I want to remember that Jeff Prabhu is trying to start a Srimad Bhagavad Gita class. This is Jeff. So contact him if you are interested in attending. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.